Feeling safe at the far end of the room, I settled next to Joe Clancy, the director of the Secret Service. Clancy, a former head of the Presidential Protective Division, had been called out of retirement by President Obama to lead the troubled agency. His wife remained in Philadelphia, so I inquired after her and their daughter, whom I'd seen sing at a ceremony marking the 150th anniversary of the Secret Service. I often joked that the Secret Service was an older sibling to the FBI, which was only a century old, and its agents had trained our first special agents. Clancy is a wonderful, warm, down-to-earth person. As he and I were chatting, the double doors opened, and White House staffers entered with tall Klieg lights, setting them up to illuminate the area farthest from me by the doors. I had guessed the location of the president's entrance correctly, but I worried that the bright lights meant there would be cameras and reporters, which struck me as unusual for an event to thank low-key law enforcement officials. Moments later, the president and vice president entered. A crush of photographers and TV cameras were ushered in and encircled the two men. The president began speaking, and his eyes swept the room at the leaders who were spread around the perimeter. His gaze passed me, mercifully, and instead came to rest on Joe Clancy. He called Joe's name and motioned him across the room to join him and the vice president. Joe never seeks the spotlight, but he dutifully walked into the near-blinding glow of TV lights. The president hugged him, awkwardly, and asked him to stand with him and the vice president as if on display. Trump then continued talking, looking to his left and away from me. I couldn't believe my luck. He hadn't seen me. How is that possible? Then it occurred to me. I was standing against a heavy blue curtain. I was wearing a blue suit that didn't match the curtain exactly, but was pretty close. It must be camouflaging me. How great is that? I was thinking, I'm so lucky they held the event in this room because I didn't have suits that blend in the green or red rooms. Now that it was my salvation, I moved even closer to the curtain, pressing my back against it, desperately trying to erase myself from the president's field of vision. I literally clung to the blue curtain, all in the hope that I could avoid an ill-advised and totally awkward televised hug from the new president of the United States. My curtain call worked, until it didn't. Still speaking in his usual stream of consciousness and free association cadence, the president moved his eyes again, sweeping from left to right, toward me and my protective curtain. This time, I was not so lucky. The small eyes with the white shadows stopped on me. "Jim," Trump exclaimed. The president called me forward. "He's more famous than me." Awesome. My wife Patrice has known me since I was 19. In the endless TV coverage of what felt to me like a 1,000-yard walk across the blue room, back at our home, she was watching TV and pointing at the screen. "That's Jim's oh shit face." Yes, it was. My inner voice was screaming, "How could he think this is a good idea? Isn't he supposed to be the master of television? This is a complete disaster, and there's no freaking way I'm going to hug him." The FBI and its director are not on anyone's political team. The entire nightmare of the Clinton email investigation had been about protecting the integrity and independence of the FBI and the Department of Justice, about safeguarding the reservoir of trust and credibility. That Trump would appear to publicly thank me on his second day in office was a threat to the reservoir. Near the end of my 1,000-yard walk, I extended my right hand to President Trump. This was going to be a handshake, nothing more. The president gripped my hand, then he pulled it forward and down. There it was. He was going for the hug on national TV. I tightened the right side of my body, calling on years of side planks and dumbbell rows. He was not going to get a hug without being a whole lot stronger than he looked. He wasn't. I thwarted the hug, but I got something worse in exchange. The president leaned in and put his mouth near my right ear. "I'm really looking forward to working with you," he said. Unfortunately, because of the vantage point of the TV cameras, what many in the world, including my children, thought they saw was a kiss. The whole world saw Donald Trump kiss the man who some believe got him elected. Surely this couldn't get any worse. President Trump made a motion as if to invite me to stand with him and the vice president and Joe Clancy. Backing away, I waved it off with a smile. "I'm not worthy," my expression tried to say. "I'm not suicidal," my inner voice said. Defeated and depressed, I retreated back to the far side of the room. The press was excused, and the police chiefs and directors started lining up for pictures with the president. They were very quiet. I made like I was getting in the back of the line and slipped out the side door, through the green room, into the hall, and down the stairs. On the way, I heard someone say the score from the Packers-Falcons game. Perfect. It's possible that I was reading too much into the usual Trump theatrics, but the episode left me worried. It was no surprise that President Trump behaved in a manner that was completely different from his predecessors. I couldn't imagine Barack Obama or George W. Bush asking someone to come on stage like a contestant on The Price is Right. What was distressing was what Trump symbolically seemed to be asking leaders of the law enforcement and national security agencies to do. To come forward and kiss the great man's ring. To show their deference and loyalty. It was tremendously important that these leaders not do that, or be seen to even look like they were doing that. Trump either didn't know that or didn't care. Though I'd spend the next several weeks quite memorably and disastrously trying to make this point to him and his staff. On Friday, January 27th, 2017, 21 days into my relationship with Donald Trump, I was back at the White House. I had been eating my lunch at my desk, as usual, when my assistant, Althea James, connected a woman calling from the White House and telling me to hold for the president. He came on the line to ask if I wanted to come over for dinner that night. This was not normal, but I felt like I had no choice. I replied, "Of course, sir." He asked whether 6 or 6:30 would be better. I said, "Whatever works for you, sir." He chose 6:30. I hung up and then called Patrice to break a Thai food dinner date. That afternoon, I saw the recently retired Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, at an event at the FBI, where we were awarding him the rare status of honorary special agent. As we stood waiting to walk on stage, I told him about the dinner invitation, explaining that it made me deeply uncomfortable. He assumed it would be a group event, saying he had heard others were being invited to dinner at the White House. That made me relax a bit. There was no way a president would be dining alone with the FBI director. Someone at the White House had to have told him that it just wasn't done, at least not since the days of Nixon and Hoover. I recalled when President Obama invited me to the White House for a wide-ranging conversation before I was nominated, because, as he explained, "Once you're director, we won't be able to talk like this," meaning he would not be able to debate wide-ranging philosophical issues with me. The head of the FBI could not be put into the position of meeting and chatting privately with the President of the United States. Especially after an election like 2016. The very notion would compromise the Bureau's hard-won integrity and independence.